Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Now's my shit together, is my shit together.
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello, we're on. Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. We have the two-headed monster, Ricky and Jim Waller, on the board over there. SP Futures up 850, NASDAQ Futures up 60. As it looks like the big, beautiful tax bill passed. Congressional Budget Office, of course, considers that it's a big, let's see, a new analysis from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that in general, resources would decrease for households in the lowest decile, a tenth of the income distribution, whereas resources would increase for households in the highest decile. God, I would have expected nothing less. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm okay.
Looks like you did good. You're in the top 10%.
A quick question, just from a production standard or a production context. Is there a reason we're still using an unrecognizable audio track? Well, it'll be unrecognizable. It's probably not unrecognizable to some of our listeners, but it's unrecognizable to anybody under the age of, I don't know, 40. That radio dial sound, dialing through an old style, like AM radio dial on a car dashboard. How come we're still using that?
Well, we hope one day to be back on the car dashboard.
Yeah, I agree, but it was just funny listening to it this morning. I haven't heard that intro for a while, and I'll.
Well, that just plays 24 hours, I think.
Say again.
We have our signal for 24 hours, so we just replay everything or something. I don't even listen in the off hours, but so I don't even know what you're talking about. I'll have to kick in tomorrow morning and see.
Well, listen to the dial-in because it's one of our recorded intros. I just haven't heard it for a while, but as I was listening to it, I was going.
Well, whenever we get new guys on the board, they manage to find stuff that I didn't think even existed anymore because we've been doing this for so long.
It's quite an anachronism, you know, especially at 5 o'clock in the morning to jolt myself awake listening, going, "What? Oh yeah, that's an old AM radio dial." I'm trying to think the last time, I don't know what you're...
I'm curious as to what you're talking about. I'm going to have to dig in and find out.
Okay, well, it's a sound effect of somebody dialing, you know, like you would sit in a car and you were trying to find a radio station, and you would turn the tuning dial and you'd hear...
Oh, really?
As your tuner goes over various frequencies. And that's what you're listening to on this on this intro that we just played.
You got me. I just sit here. Those guys play the intro, and I just wait till they say go. So that's where I am. So you got a new one on me.
Okay. Well, for our listeners, what you heard with that jumbled sound track running in the background for part of the intro is what you got in an old car radio system when did push buttons come in for a mechanical tuning, but anyway, it's the sound of somebody sweeping a tuner manually, mechanically, over a frequency band with radio stations on it, and you get a snip of the radio station, whatever they're playing, as the tuner sweeps over that radio station's frequency, and it's instantly recognizable if you've experienced it, but if you haven't, you don't know what you're listening to. So
well, it's like the dial phone.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
By the way, this house that Audrey's helping clean out, there's an old wall dial phone on there.
There was a thing that popped up on Twitter maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago where, you know, it said, say something that nobody under the age of 30 is going to recognize or would ever say, or something over the age of like 40 would say that somebody else would never say. And the line was, I lost my phone. And you just, if you grew up with, you know, Ma Bell, the idea of losing your telephone is, what do you mean you lost your phone?
Isn't it hanging on the kitchen wall where it always
that's
was?
Right. You can't, it's not like something that just sort of detaches and you carry around with you, is it? And of course, now it is. So
yeah, it's crazy stuff. When the, I find myself using sometimes a movie reference that, well, I will say this, our Monday producer, Matt Byrne, enough people on the show have kind of mentioned Casablanca, and he watched it this weekend. He goes, I was just fascinated. I got to go watch it again. All the lines, all the different stuff that was in there, and the black and white, and how the photography, he does a lot of photography. He goes, I can't believe how good those guys were.
Oh, yeah. Well, we always sort of underestimate the capability of earlier technologies and the capability of people to understand earlier technologies. It's like if you go look at the Parthenon or any of the sort of classical Greek or classical Roman construction projects, you'll be amazed. How did they do that? How did they construct the Great Pyramid of Cheops with no effective mechanical devices? And we fall into a trap that we don't inquire what the background technology was that got us to this point. One of my favorite stories is when I was taking one of my engineering classes. And a professor, held up a pencil, and he said, "Do you understand that this very basic, simple thing, is something that most of you have absolutely no idea how it's constructed, and couldn't make one?
No.
If you had to.
You imagine if we had if somebody today had to reinvent the cash register, the manual cash register, how long would that take?
I think it would take a while. We have some basic understandings of how things work, but a watch, even with a stopwatch timer, it's amazing, and this is as we run down one rabbit hole after another. This is one of the themes of a number of books that have been written recently about what would happen if we had an EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse attack on the country, and we suddenly lost electricity and we lost the ability to generate it, and none of our stuff, even if you could generate it, none of your stuff would work. How fast things fall apart because we just don't have the skill set to manage without all these devices that make our life easier.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know. I think my feedback, the listeners really liked a few times that Bill Moriarty's come out, my engineer buddy, and just
as opposed to the rest of us.
Well, no, it's different. We're not talking about the market. We're talking about big projects and lead times and how you do it. And I mean, it's just fascinating, because otherwise people just blow over that stuff. And we were talking actually when we were young. We went and visited Hoover Dam together, and nothing is more educational than visiting some place like that with an engineer at your side, kind of explaining even more than they explained to you there. And I said to him, Bill, how did they figure out how to, when you put a dam up of any kind, one of the biggest issues you have is water wants to get under the dam. There's so much weight down there, it usually can find a way through. And he said they had all kinds of dams that they put up that basically collapsed and were compromised, and every time they learned something a little bit more. And finally, when they got to Hoover Dam, they did everything they could to make sure it didn't happen there. I mean, and they, it wasn't just you know, they thought it off the top of their head. There were other specific spots that, because people in those industries all kind of know kind of each other, and this all kind of gets around, even before there was an internet, of what mistake was made one place, one mistake was made somewhere else, and it kind of builds on each other until you get to this.
You know who's doing that? And we get to watch this in real time, and that's SpaceX.
Yeah.
With their Starship. As you watch, and you know, this is a mindset that NASA has abandoned. I think people don't either remember or know that NASA blew up, and so did the Soviet Union, by the way. They just didn't talk about it. NASA blew up rocket after rocket after rocket, trying to get, you know, a Mercury capsule into space. And when they launched Shepard, first on the suborbital flight, and then they launched Glenn on the orbital flight, there was still substantial question in the minds of those engineers as to whether they'd gotten everything right on those rockets. So, I mean,
when you have many moving parts, every rocket that goes up. what did Bill say the other day? When you start to turn on one of these plants, the turn-on process is enormous.
Yep.
Does everything going to work? And if it doesn't, if you're putting compressed air into water and all of a sudden the compressed air doesn't work, the thing could blow.
Yeah.
So
as somebody who has watched, let me say, first of all, I have a number of friends of mine who are astronauts. And I will never forget one of them who had, I think Tom had four or five shuttle missions. But he candidly, we were at dinner one night, and he candidly said, the American people really do not understand how dangerous that spacecraft is and how dangerous it is doing even basic space work. But he said that the rockets are, he said, we're under no illusions that we are basically sitting on a controlled explosion, and that controlled explosion has to be funneled and channeled by technology that is literally on a knife's edge of balance. And if it tips one way or the other, it's catastrophic. And he said, we all know, all of us in the program understand it, we accept the risk, but if something goes wrong up there, it's going to go wrong in a hurry, and it's going to go wrong for all of us. And this was after Columbia. And you see that now with the Starship. You know, I mean, space flight is really hard.
Did you
and you have to watch this time, and trial and error. We make a mistake, it blows up. Okay, let's fix it again.
I know
NASA's gotten away from that, and that's one of the reasons why their systems are not very good.
Well, I know you're a young pup. Do you remember? I'm sure you remember, but there used to be a, God, I don't remember when it was on, Lou, but I must have seen it 10 times. And it was about a 10 or 15 minute film blurb of, I mean, when you see a rocket launch right now, and you like you say, this is not easy. You see one go up, you see this thing going like straight up in the air. And all of a sudden, it bends to the right just like they want it to and heads for space. You sit there and go, wait a minute. Nobody's steering the damn thing. There's three or four things at the bottom that are pushing it. How do you make sure the thing stays upright with the wind and everything else? There was a thing that they used to put on, and boy, maybe you can find it. It showed all the times, like, before that happened, where a rocket would, like, come off the ground and just go over inside the land. And
Remember, what was that?
There was a film of some kind. They must have had 20 or 30 in a row where things would make it up about 40 feet and just land and collapse. And I like the ones where they went up and they just fell over on their sides. How many times did you do that before you go, wow? I mean,
it's a measure of... In your program, it's a measure of either corporate or national will, where you have somebody who says, look, it blew up. Okay, you know, I mean, Musk said, okay, it blew up. Do you think NASA would be able to function, I mean, with its current culture after seven or eight of its rockets had exploded on test flights?
No, but they did it one time.
They did it one time, but they don't now. And you know, one of the things, if you look at the history of that culture, it got scarred real badly by Apollo 1. You remember that was the fire.
Yeah.
That killed, that burned the three guys to death in the Apollo capsule in, what was it, 67?
Yeah, that was it was on the ground.
On the ground, right. Yeah. But that scarred the program. They, you know, oh my God, we got people killed. And I'm sorry, when the most important thing you do is not to get people killed, you lose, first of all, you don't make progress as quickly. When you do make progress, it's frequently contorted by your decision-making process, so it's such that when you decide that you're willing to start taking risks, you don't have a handle on the nature of the risks you're actually taking. And that was Challenger, you know, when they launched in cold weather and hadn't, you know, they decided, okay, we're gonna push on this. And
well, they were pushing when there was no reason to. It wasn't like it was wartime or something.
Well, no, and that's what I mean. They, at that point, they did not, because of the culture, they did not have a good assessment of what that system was going to do on certain extreme temperatures.
And what was the, and here's the, a wild question for you. When people, you know, I went down to Wright Patterson a couple times, and I was just fascinated by the Wright brothers stuff. And the, you know, and I took space tech of all things at Notre Dame, and there was a massive connection between like paper airplanes, small, you know, planes you just put together, the little what do you call the wood that's almost not wood, balsa wood type of stuff, and the aerodynamics of small stuff versus big stuff is actually, you can learn a lot from small stuff, right? When people used to do the small rockets and stuff, people used to love doing rocket stuff when I was a kid. Is there that kind of a correlation between the small rocket stuff and the big ones like there is between... I mean, you could put a small balsa plane in a wind tunnel and learn from it, you know, then apply it to a 747, for God's sake. Does the same thing happen with rockets technology?
The stuff that you and I launched as a kid, the Estes rockets with the little solid fuel rocket motors...
Well, I never did that. I saw guys doing it. But.
Okay, I did. I launched 100, 150 of those things.
Did they wreck every time they landed, or did you get to use them again?
No, you get a parachute. You have a little parachute, yeah, and you learn. I mean, you learn some aerodynamics. You learn about balancing your thing in flight. You learn about redundancy in terms of trying to protect a model that you've spent a lot of time in and make sure it's going to come back to Earth safely. You learn about what happens if you don't follow the instructions exactly.
Was there a controller, or it was all just as soon as you let it up, it just went on its own?
Well, it was a solid fuel, so these were all solid fuel rockets, you know, model rockets. So you basically lit, you were putting a fuse into the bottom of a solid fuel rocket and motor and then igniting it. They were ignited electrically, but you basically lit this thing and then it would climb. Now, if you look at model rocketry now, they start with that, but you've got amateur shops shooting rockets to 250,000, 300,000 feet.
Wow.
With cameras and GPS on them. And these guys are literally rocket engineers. I mean, they're Robert Goddard on steroids. They've built their own little liquid fuel systems and they make their rocket fuel.
We can't do that in a city. Where can you blow those things off?
Oh, they take them out in the Mojave Desert.
Really?
Out in Nevada. There's a whole get on YouTube sometime and just look up model rocket, you know, records.
Well, that'd be a fun afternoon or morning hang with those guys.
It's really interesting to watch. But yes, these kids doing this and young adults doing this are learning the basics of what it takes to design something that can survive Mach 4, Mach 5 at high altitude, orient itself, take pictures, you know, free fall down to a safe altitude and deploy a parachute, all that stuff.
What used to signal yours to put the parachute out, just when it ran out of gas?
No, there was the solid rocket motor would burn through, stop producing thrust, and then there was a section of the solid motor that was a smoke powder that would also burn. And as that smoke powder burned, it was called a tracking charge, and it would generate a smoke trail coming out of the back of the rocket. And so you could see it, you know, I mean, ours went up, like I think I got mine as high as 6,000 or 7,000 feet.
Oh, that's pretty far.
You, you'd see the smoke trail coming out of it, and then when the smoke trail, when this powder burned through, the tracking powder burned through, there was a small explosive charge that would violently explode inside the rocket, and that explosive push would push out. You put this non-flammable, they called it wadding, you put this non-flammable, like toilet paper, stuffed it into the tube of the rocket, and so when the charge blew, it would hit this non-flammable stuff and push it out, and then your nose cone would be pushed out. And the plastic parachute was attached to the nose cone, which was attached to the rocket body, so it would push all this out at one pop, and then as the thing continued to fall, the parachute would, you hope, inflate. If you didn't put enough wadding in the rocket tube body, your explosive charge would melt your plastic parachute and you'd have a crash. If you put too much wadding in, it wouldn't push the nose cone out, you'd have a crash. If you hadn't properly wound the, they called it a shock cord, it was a rubber cord that attached the nose cone to the rocket body. If you hadn't properly attached that thing, when the parachute deployed, your rocket body would separate from the nose cone and it would fall, crash. So there were lots of different ways you could destroy these things.
Did you have any idea which direction this thing was going, other than up?
No, but they were designed, the motors were not so powerful that you had the thing going supersonic, at 10 feet. It generally was a controlled burn so that the thing stabilized itself. If you didn't put your fins together properly, you would get a radically screwed up flight. I had one.
What if the thing just went sideways to somebody's house?
I had one do that. I launched it, and one of my fin mountings that I glued on there detached. So the fin destabilized as it was accelerating off the launch rail, and it did like five loops horizontally. It was very impressive to watch. Five circles, full loops across a football field, and then buried itself in the dirt. You had stuff happen. They weren't, they were made out of balsa wood and cardboard, so you weren't gonna. It wasn't like you were gonna get hit with a, anything with metal in it.
All right. So it wasn't like you were 10 pounds or anything.
No. But you didn't. I mean, obviously, you didn't want to be in the vicinity of one if it was coming at you. But you took basic safety precautions and watched what you were doing, and so. But you learned. I mean, you learned a ton. You learned, design. They would look at your rocket body and set up a center. Make sure the center of gravity wasn't too far forward. You would have to make sure your fins were aligned perfectly so that if they are off by a degree or two on the mounting on the rocket body, the thing would start to tumble. It was a fascinating experience. As I said, the clubs now that are out there now are pretty advanced. So you can see some pretty interesting stuff if you look at those videos.
Well, this person at Audrey's friend, person who just passed recently, had all these controls for model airplanes. All these really technical, you can see the, like a little joystick essentially in your hand.
Yep.
Evidently nobody uses any of that stuff anymore. It's all radio controlled.
Yes. Oh yeah. Go on YouTube. There's some stuff about, guys flying Boeing 747s and B-52s that are like 1/10 scale. They're $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 models.
Wow.
And they fly, they've got little jet engines and they fly around and they bomb bay doors open and landing gear to go up and down.
If you screw up one of those things, it's a bad day.
Oh yeah. Oh, and they do. I wanted to just talk real quickly about an issue that I gotta quit saying an issue that is arising in sports, so we get our sports segment out of the way, and that is the situation with Bill Belichick at North Carolina.
I've heard bits and pieces of that, but other than going out with some younger lady and trying to essentially his kid has become the coach, what else is there involved? That's enough. But
well, so now we have a story. It's so stereotypical. It's almost comical. Except it involves a guy that I had a fair amount of respect for as a football coach, and I'm a Duke guy. So anytime UNC gets a black eye, I'm generally in favor of it. But this is sort of almost Joe Biden-y in terms of the way it's looking. So Belichick is dating. I mean, I don't know exactly whether this woman, how she came into his life. Nobody really does, and what the circumstances were. But he's what, 69? I think he's as old as I am. He's like 70, and this woman is 24. So it's not the first time
that's happened.
No, but it's not. So that's one issue. You know, you do wonder what they talk about, but apparently what they talk about is business. So she came to national prominence when it became apparent that she was directing almost every aspect of Belichick's life, and she cut off a CBS interview, and she comes across as really flinty. I don't know what she's like in person, but in any event, she cut off a CBS interview she just told him, we're not answering that question. She was sitting off camera. She insisted on being there. And they asked Belichick, how did you guys meet? And she said, we're not answering that question. You can hear her voice come in from off camera. We're not answering that question. We're not talking about that.
And he knuckled under.
Oh yeah, immediately. That was the end. That was the end of that part of the interview. So now it's turned out, there's a report out that the Hard Knocks program, which is an HBO inside football program, I didn't know they were looking at colleges, but they've done NFL teams every year. They pick a team, they come in and during summer practice, and they video everything. They video coaches' meetings, they video the players, they video the practices, they sit down, they follow the cameras, and then they produce what in some cases is pretty interesting television if you are interested in how football programs work. And so they were very interested in filming at UNC because North Carolina had hired who is arguably the greatest professional football coach of all time in terms of one loss and you know, championship performance, and that's Belichick. And
you know, he's going the most interesting compliment from Tony Dungy that I've ever heard. I remember it to this day. Tony Dungy said, whenever you played Belichick, there was no point in watching game films because it would be totally different design for you, and you didn't know what he was going to do until he actually saw it.
They rewrite their playbook. Well, you remember we had a long talk about this one time when Matt was the producer about what the New England Patriots were doing and how they were drafting. But anyway, the move of this guy from pro to college was going to be something interesting to do. Well, so this was agreed to. They showed up on campus on February 28th. The agreement was all signed. Because by this time, Belichick's been announced as head coach. And apparently, according to these reports, this woman's name is Jordan Hudson. According to these reports, she steps into the middle of this whole thing and says, I want operational control over the parts of the program, and I want part ownership of the result. And apparently that discussion lasted about 10 seconds because HBO said goodbye and they were off campus by March 3rd. They took all their stuff and just left.
Like some grad student, or she got an MBA? I mean, does anybody have any idea what her background is?
Like a Miss Runner-Up, Miss Maine.
Miss Maine? I mean, well, okay,
Miss Maine? Yeah, she was like a beauty pageant person.
So at least she's hot.
No, I don't. Well, matter of opinion, okay.
Right.
At if you, let me put it this way, I don't think she's particularly attractive, but if you're 70 years old and you're being pursued by a 24-year-old, you your standards are, you know, different.
Well, you know your hero. I know he had to be one of your heroes. Did that and ended up with like four kids and made it to like 95. Wasn't that Strom Thurmond?
Oh man, that guy. Holy cow.
But didn't he make it like another 20 years? Yeah, very good health. He made it another 20 years. How many kids did he have with her?
The current press secretary for the president, that very energetic young woman, blonde woman, she's 29, 30, and her husband is 59. There's like a 30-year age gap.
Yeah, you know, you signed me on this way back in the day about people getting still Civil War pensions. And I dug up the one guy. Remember the dude we talked about? That the guy, he started out on the Confederate side and somehow ended up on the Union side. But he was still getting his daughter was still getting a pension. The guy.
Yeah, he married it. He married it like 70, fathered a child at like 72.
Not one, like four or five.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He also, he went to the 75th anniversary of Gettysburg. He went to the thing and he fought there, I guess. He was like 95 or something. And
well, yeah. Well, if you have a child, foster a child late in life, you can extend it. There was so in any event, before we run off on, because I'm about to mention Millard Fillmore, and I don't mean to take us down that far down another rabbit hole.
But he's a president, correct?
That's right. The Belichick saga. So this story hits, and I don't know if the Belichick people have responded to it. He was using her for everything. She was his PR person, his business advisor, da 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 da. And he's very smartly pushed her off or got her out of the limelight and moved a professional PR person in. But from a sports law perspective, from a sports perspective, you look at that and go, man, I hope this guy's brain is still functional given what we think is happening. But the other thing is, from an employment lawyer perspective, I saw that story and I just thought, okay, you're UNC, you are the face of North Carolina, and probably 70% of that, well, no, maybe 60% of that state lives and dies by your football team and basketball team's performance. And then
they're like Nebraska, no pro teams, right?
Well, they're pro football team in Charlotte.
Yeah,
now,
okay.
The Panthers. But they live and die by that program, and the other 40% live and die by North Carolina State. So, and then maybe 1% live and die with Duke. You've got this situation now that's developed where you've spent millions bringing in this guy that you think is going to save your football program and turn it around, and he's bringing in a lot of publicity, and all of a sudden, he's got this person. Who, you know, I mean, not only generates all the salacious comments because she's, you know, she's reasonably good looking. She's a beauty pageant contestant, but who now suddenly seems to be inserting herself. She's not an employee, inserting herself into all of his business decisions. And you're not negotiating with him, you're negotiating with her, and her personal fortune has seemed to have done real well. All of a sudden, she's a real estate developer at 24, with multiple properties. Multiple million-dollar properties in Connecticut and in the Northeast. Where did that money come from? And so now she's in the middle of this business development with Belichick. And you, if you're the North Carolina administration, you're going, okay, we've now got this guy's girlfriend, the coach, head coach's girlfriend is now somebody that the players would be interested in dating. You know, I mean, there's that much of an age differential. Jason Whitlock said, I guarantee you, there's a contest going on in that football program or in that athletic department with those players, saying, okay, who could get this woman into bed first? And there's discussion on that going on right now. This is Whitlock.
What happened to the son? Wasn't the thinly veiled thing in the beginning was he was going to start out the program and his son was going to end up being the head coach? That was the original
That may still be the plan.
Nobody ever mentioned her.
I'll tell you, she's right there. And this Hard Knock story, if you're from an employment lawyer perspective, you're sitting there and you've got your star who comes in with this inexperienced, very young, hot girlfriend who is pulling strings in addition to whatever else she's pulling. And as an employer, you're sitting there going, I didn't sign up for this. She's not on my payroll. Why are we dealing with her? And it's not a normal agent situation either. And so if you're North Carolina, you're looking around and thinking to yourself, I gotta get control of this.
What if he turned around and hired her as his agent? Well, how would that change it?
Well, it could change it if to the extent you had if you were telling the school, look, I'm going to let you deal with my agent on my contract, but that's not what we've got. It's not just a question of you deal with her on my contract. She comes on the practice field and talks to him about, presumably, about what plays to call or what players that she likes or God knows what else, what color scheme to paint the stadium. She's in his interviews telling what questions there he's going to answer. She's and now she interposes herself on this Hard Knocks decision, allegedly, and is saying, yeah, I want part ownership of the program.
Her being part of what he says is one thing. Her wanting part of the money is quite another.
Oh yeah. So this gets really really interesting and you know.
But I mean, the university didn't even demand part of the money.
No. And you can only imagine what the HBO guys want. You want what? You want ownership? You want an ownership share?
Back
of
up
this?
Here. When you say you, was it him, the university, or her? Who's the you?
Her. She wanted part ownership.
She
of
wanted
the
not
program.
Even him. Wow! You blew that one by. I thought she meant they wanted.
No. No. She wanted her name on the credits as a producer, apparently, and she wanted part ownership of whatever the product was. So if you're HBO, the first thing you're saying to yourself is, we're not. What do you mean part ownership?
Well, you might give it to him or to school. You sure as hell aren't going to give it to her.
No, and you don't give artistic. You don't release artistic control either to some person with absolutely no experience, whose only connection to this whole operation appears to be either romance. I'll put it politely and say it's romantic. But I just, from an employment perspective, I could just see the North Carolina Board of Regents going to their legal team and saying, you need to solve this. How do we deal with this? And as you know, as an employment lawyer, you come in and say, all right, let's start drawing lines. I want a straight line from what's the line from whoever hired this guy.
Have you ever even seen something like this
him.
Before?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever even seen something? I mean, what would be the what's the playbook for dealing with this?
I have seen something like this before. It was when I was working with a major law firm, and we were dealing with a guy who was a multi-gazillionaire who had designed this product that sold all over the world. And his paramour, and so this guy's in his maybe his 60s, and his quote girlfriend unquote was a woman, I think she was 20 years older than he was, so you can do the math. And she inserted herself into everything, and
she's 85 and she wants in.
Yeah. And so we were in the middle of it, and I finally, you know, I sat down with his internal business people and said, look, I know he bows to whatever she wants to do, and I get it, but you know, she can't sit in on meetings with us because she's not a part of the management team officially, and we can't draw straight lines putting her into the attorney-client relationship. There's no straight line that goes from our legal advice to her in any role, official role that she has. And
so
we don't represent
her. So what does he say?
Her.
Okay, I'll just make it official. She's my assistant.
He could do that, but that still wouldn't get her, wouldn't save the privilege. She's got to be involved to such an extent that you know, she's part of the formal management team for us.
She's
got to
get copies
privilege.
Of the agendas and all the other stuff. Which,
well, she's got to have some kind of an organizational authority that makes it necessary for her to be briefed in on the legal issues. So, I just think if I'm North Carolina, I'm sitting, got to sit Belichick down. This is a hard discussion. The first thing you got to do is you sit him down without her, and that might be impossible, and just say, look, Bill, you know, you can run amok on your own time to an extent, but to an extent that this starts to blow back on the university in terms of our reputation or how we're doing business, what you're doing in your free time is going to be a problem, number one. Number two, you can't, she's not part of this. We didn't sign her to a contract. We signed you. So let's figure out how we, you know, limit her role. I think they did have some type of conversation like that recently, because after the CBS interview, the 60 Minutes interview blew up, as I said, he got a formal public relations person to, you know, sort of put the hammer down. But it looks really weird and really problematic. And if you're an employment lawyer, these are the kinds of things I get asked to solve.
Well, how much of this stuff, what is a stupid question, huh? How much of this stuff used to go on before there was, you know, X and the internet and other stuff, and it was all just kind of rumors and nobody... I suspect if somebody showed up at an actual press conference, it wouldn't be a rumor. It still would have been covered in those days, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And these stories would get out. I mean, somebody would talk to a reporter and say, have you seen what's happening with this woman? And a law, you know, a lawsuit gets filed and alludes to it. Which is the case with I think it's an former Arizona WNBA player. The club fired, I think, the security manager. The WNBA team had a security manager. They fire him. He sues for wrongful termination, and in the lawsuit, he says that there, you know, he was taught, one of the people was talking about the fact that the owner of the WNBA franchise was sleeping with one of the WNBA players on the team, and that this was an allegation in the lawsuit.
Why is that a problem?
Well, you don't want your owner in a sexual relationship with one of the players, because if you're the coach or the GM and you have to cut her, or you have to not play her as much, you know, you end up in a real problematic situation where you have non-business decisions being made and on the basis of something other than what's going to be best for the club. And I'm sorry, can you imagine a basketball team where one of the any sports team where one of the players is sleeping with like the coach or the owner.
We had the coach. Probably not great for team dynamics,
especially on a women's team.
Well, I mean,
we had
the coach sleeping with and marrying the owner's daughter at the Lakers.
That's different. That doesn't affect team dynamics.
Oh, okay, I get it.
My point is this stuff gets out.
Yeah,
it gets out. It's not as instantly disseminated as it is now, but I would tell you just to watch this situation in North Carolina and see what happens, because I'm getting the impression that as the school starts to clamp down on the activities of this person, that Belichick is, one of two things is going to happen: either Belichick's going to blow up, or she's going to leave him. I would guess, because he's no longer giving her the access and control that she demands.
And where's the son in all this mess? The guy who was supposed to be involved.
I have absolutely no idea. I have not seen a reference to him since this.
Well, since he got hired, yeah, pretty much.
Since this person appeared. So
she's in, the son's out, eh?
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's some things, you know. Blood's not thicker than some things, apparently.
I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but the saga of this plane. We have a guy that seems to be able to institute a whole bunch of fear on a bunch of people. Now the Defense Department has accepted the plane and say it's going to be used as Air Force One. Now, I've read all kinds of stuff that says this thing is so far behind the two they already have that just putting the, if you wanted to retrofit it and put it into be able to be on air refueling, that's a 2.5 year project on its own.
Yep.
I mean, what are we doing with this thing? Is this just the biggest
well for one thing, first of all,
we've ever come across?
First of all, this process was started under the Biden people. They were talking to the Qataris about getting this airplane. And that,
well, what is so special about this plane? I mean,
it's new. And so I think in his own, let me just sort of give you a corporate view of what's going on or what could be going on.
Well, before that, the two that are currently being outfitted as Air Force One, this has been about a 5-year project, and those were planes that were at the end of the line of the 747, which they don't make anymore. Weren't they destined for something else, and somehow or another the Defense Department snagged them and started the retrofit of them? On day one, they weren't being built as Air Force One. They were two planes that were completed and they weren't sold or something. There was some story.
I don't know. I don't know what the circumstances were. I just know that those airplanes are 40 years old. And
well, the design is.
Well, the planes are.
Well, you're talking about the current ones.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the current ones in construction.
No, I'm talking about the current ones that are being flown right now as Air Force One.
But there's another group that's, the contract went out for $3.6 billion.
Right.
And now it's five point something, they're still not done.
And so if you're Donald Trump, you come in, you know, this process started under the Obama administration. So you're Donald Trump, you were president for 4 years, you hear about this new airplane you're supposed to get. Okay, that's great. Good, let's get this done. Then you go out of office for 5 years, and now you're back. And you say, where's my new airplane? And they say, oh, we haven't finished it yet. So if you know what you do if you're a businessman? You say, well, you had your chance, Boeing.
Okay.
And I'm going to go somewhere else.
I was involved in a Amtrak contract that totally blew up, and it was almost as late as this thing. I'm going to say that virtually all the problems, this is right out of my behind, almost all the problems are government change orders.
Could well be. You know what? If I'm the guy in charge, I don't care. I come in, I say it's not fixed. I'm gonna go somewhere else.
Okay,
I'm gonna do it in a way that's gonna be the maximum black eye for Boeing and for the Defense Department.
Okay, and the problem with the new planes, Lou, I suspect, and again, this is kind of my bailiwick, the problem with the new planes is all the retrofitting that are being done to them. Starting from scratch.
I'm sure you're right.
Anywhere.
I'm sure you're right, but it doesn't matter.
Sometimes one of these days, this guy's got to say something that matters.
To the guy in charge, to the president, who says, and I'm with him on this, who says, this thing should have been in my hip pocket. I should have had a brand new airplane to fly around on when I came in here.
He does use the I word, doesn't he?
It doesn't matter. Yeah, but that's what we elected. That's what you elected him for.
He's
the president. He gets to stand up and say, I am the president. This is my airplane while I am the president. Where is the new airplane I was promised? It's not here? Okay, watch this.
Okay,
I'm going to go somewhere else.
There's no way he's getting on this plane.
That's not the point. The point is not for him to have a new airplane.
I think that is the point. It's all about him. But
you've just said he's not going to get it.
He's not going to get to use it as Air Force One. He's going to get it when he's out of office.
But that may be the case. Well, we'll see. I'm not convinced that's going to happen. I know he may have made an offhand remark somewhere, and of course the anti-Trump press jumps on it and inflates it to a certainty. But regardless. I'm going to go get a new airplane. We're going to solve this problem. We're going to solve it now.
Okay.
The Biden people were negotiating to buy this thing. I'm going to finalize it. We're going to buy it. I'm going to wave it in front of Boeing's nose and say, this is how I'm going to get an airplane.
But he's not going to get the airplane this way.
But he is.
How?
There's
no way he's plopping his ass on this thing tomorrow and having an Air Force One.
He's He's fixing a problem. Here's the airplane I want. And I'm waving in front of Boeing's nose saying, you guys can't build airplanes.
This is kind of my bailiwick. Let me just talk for 2 seconds here. You've got a retrofit of a plane that's taking a long time because of the stuff you want done to it. And I'm sure the thing has the capability of being in the air for what, 30 days?
You are not in your sweet spot on this, because the sweet spot on this has nothing to do with engineering.
It has nothing to do with his blowhard. But what I'm saying,
it has to do with the mentality of a senior person who is used to having his own way and getting things done quickly.
All right. So the part I'm trying to shove out to the listeners here, without personalities involved, has to do with you started with a plane like this 6 years ago. And the stuff you decide you want to do to the damn thing is so intense and so technologically advanced to make this thing the most... It ends up being one of the most technically advanced piece of machinery in the world, if not the most. So the idea that you're going to now start over with another plane and somehow catch up, that's insane if you're going to get to the same place. Now, if he's going to say, I don't care if there's two, I don't care if there's in-air refueling, I don't care if you check the thing for bugs, I'm just going to start riding it tomorrow... Well, that's a different story, but I don't think that's what's going to happen to you.
But no, he's not. He's not going to do that. He's going to ride in the 40-year-old airframes until then. But every day that he gets on there, he's going to say, "I can hardly wait till that new plane gets here."
Well, that's
because I know it's coming. As opposed to,
Do you think that should be his job? Don't you think the president is like It's like the person who the three or four or maybe ten people in Congress that trade all day.
Some respects, this is his job.
To do what?
To send a very clear message to the government contracting community that I am not going to put up with your excrement.
Does he even know what the holdup is?
It doesn't matter. Again, you're approaching this from an engineering perspective. This is not an engineering problem. This is a government culture problem, and that's what he's addressing with this. At least this is my theory. He comes in, he says, I had this plane. This plane's been on order since the beginning of my first administration, 10 years ago. Where the heck is the airplane? It's not here. Okay. Then screw you guys.
Is it 99% of the way run, where you could get in it and say that's good enough, or the thing won't fly?
Presumably no, and his the frustrate. What you're seeing is the frustration of somebody who is used to getting things done, bumping up against a culture that is not interested in getting
things done. He also doesn't realize the magnitude. You could run out the Hoover Dam and say, why isn't it done in a month? All you do is make a fool out of yourself.
None of that matters.
Well, it
his point is there's a contract. It's more than 10 years old. It's for an airplane. It's not for faster than light travel. It's not for cold fusion. It's for an airplane. Where's my airplane? Where's the government's airplane? It's not here? Okay. We're not... The heck with you! I'm going to go someplace else, and I'm going to make a big issue out of it, so that in addition to whatever opprobrium gets heaped on me, which I could not care less about, the opprobrium that's going to get heaped on Boeing and the embarrassment to Boeing is going to be palpable.
What makes you think the embarrassment's Boeing's?
Because they didn't deliver the product.
But what makes you think the specs haven't changed 50 times since they started building it?
It doesn't matter.
Sure, it does.
Tom, not to him.
Okay, but
to him, what matters is where is my airplane?
But here's the root problem I have with a lot of people, some of whom, boy, I absolutely respect their mentality. I'm not willing to change the way I think and the way this country thinks to the way he does. I don't want to be anything like him. I don't want, Bill Moriarty talked the other day, if you want to put a desalination plant in, it's a 10 to 15 year project.
Yep.
I don't want some buffoon jumping in the middle saying, I want my desalinator next month or I'm starting with some other contract. You have to understand what you're talking about before you talk. At least most people try to do that.
But, you know, we're not talking about desalinization. As I said, we're not talking about faster than light travel or cold fusion. We're talking about an airplane.
Here's the part that I don't get, Lou. You and I, if it was us, and you and I think have the same sort of mentality on a lot of things. I don't know if that's not a compliment to you, I guess. But
I agree with you.
I mean, if it was you and me, we'd say, okay, where the hell are we with this plane? And have somebody come in and say, these are the open items. And you and I might say, I don't care about those open items. They don't involve safety. They don't involve anything else. I don't care if the news guy's got their third bathroom or something. I mean, let's just go with it now, and we'll retrofit it as we go. That's the way you and I would do it with the ones that are there. To just run out and accuse Boeing and accuse these, you have no idea if the last change didn't come from his office, for God's sake.
What I'm telling you is it doesn't matter in the scheme.
It does to me because I don't want a buffoon in their office.
I don't want
him acting like one.
It's too late.
I know. Okay.
You got what you got. So my point is, this makes perfect sense from the perspective of a frustrated senior executive person whom I have counseled on, not this guy, but others like him very much, on many occasions, who have directed a problem to be solved, and it's not getting done, and nobody can tell me. You know, in a classic bureaucratic style, nobody can tell me who's responsible. Nobody can point to a particular agency that's responsible. So I'm going to go back to the people that I signed the contract with and say, where's my airplane? It's not here? Okay. Watch this. You're going to regret not having that airplane ready for me.
Okay, so I mean, but somewhere along the line, there might have been 10 or 15 change orders.
It doesn't matter. Okay?
I guess you could run over to the lady that you had sex with and demand a baby after 6 months, but you're not going to get anywhere, Lou.
I'm not sure about that analogy, and I'm going to leave that for Andrew and Carl, who are coming on now.
I'm saying
they can match
the
that
first
one
is,
up.
My rant really is certainly not against you. I mean,
my
rant is, how is it that this thing has been back and forth from the press? And whether you like Trump, whether you like his style, whether you don't, whether you're pissed at Boeing, why doesn't somebody somewhere who's got an ounce of brains write some article? By now, you and I should have been able to read the history of this contract. Was it 2 years down the road when they say, oh, no, the entire refueling mechanism that you took 2 years to put in, that's not what we want to use anymore. We got these new... I mean, we can read that makes sense, and we're not. You know, we're dumbing down the whole world here, for God's sake.
I'm going to leave you with this. You know what that tells you, that you haven't read one of those stories? It's not embarrassing to Trump. It's embarrassing to Boeing or somebody else, but it's not embarrassing to Trump. And if it's not embarrassing to Trump,
what makes you think that he wasn't half of the change orders in his first term?
Your press is not going to cover it. I'm going to get out of your feed here so that our other guests could take over. I will be talking to you. I won't be around next week, so we need a sub, and then I'll be back on the air.
Are you going to be one of the first guys to get a ride on this new plane?
I'm actually going to go to see about this whole retrofitting story.
God, just make sure you don't launch one of your rockets and hit yourself.
I'm actually going to go look for a 24-year-old girlfriend.
Oh God. When you were in Chicago, remember when George Dunn was having the affair when he was like 80 with the 45-year-old lady who worked for the county, and everybody's like, "Leave the guy alone."
Listen. From a personal perspective, more power to Bill.
Oh God!
All right, see you later.
S&P futures down 19. NASDAQ futures were down. We were up just like yesterday. We were up in the NASDAQ in the morning. We came flying back down. Do we have our guys? We got Wayne and Andrew.
Yes, good morning.
Which one of you guys is going to write me a huge story about all the change orders and the new Air Force Ones that don't seem to be able to ever get delivered? Have any idea what's going on there?
I have known people who worked in procurement for a number of years. You might remember back when 60 Minutes did a story when Nixon was president about the new, I think it was the new C-5 huge cargo plane the Air Force was manufacturing. And one of the government budget analysts, a late friend of mine, Ernie Fitzgerald, saw that they were charging the government, you know, $500 for a toilet seat and, you know, $100 for a hammer. And this got to Nixon's attention, and he fired Ernie, but the Congress restored him to his proper position. This type of procurement issue is, it seems to be an endemic with just the government system.
Well, you know, when that all happened, I was a younger dude, you know, the $1,000 toilet and all this kind of stuff, and I was the financial program manager for these MBTA cars that we were building for Boston. I don't know if you've ever ridden on the Purple Line were our cars, and during the procurement stage, my job was to constantly talk to the people at the MBTA about what kind of spare parts do you want. And I got my guys together, I asked the program managers, what do you think they should order? And by the way, the cab cars had a bathroom on there, the rest of the cars didn't. Most commuter cars, not every car's got a bathroom on it. It's where the cab end, there's one out of three or four cars has a bathroom. Anyway, and then there's end caps for the thing, and there's different seats, and there's all kinds of crap. And it's a big deal. I must have sent those guys, you know, back when there was no internet, I probably sent those guys 10 letters. Here's my recommendations. I got to know on this stuff. I got to let the seat guys know by such and such a date. I got to know the end cap guys by such and such a date. They never answered me, ever. And all of a sudden, one day, when the thing is, the last car is rolling out of the place, and all the tooling is now piled up outside in a big rusty pile, I get this letter, we want all this stuff. And I'm going, guys. And they made me reprice it on all special. So I had to go back to the guy who made literally the toilet. And he goes, I gave you the price a year ago. That whatever stamp or whatever that thing is, that's gone. If you want me to make it over again, it literally was $1,000 a toilet. This is 50 years
yes.
ago. I mean, whenever I hear something like that, I wonder, whose fault is it? It isn't necessarily, because it's not just a hammer. It's a special hammer. And I bet they bought 500 of them, and the guy said, do you want any extras?
Yes.
And they said no, and then all of a sudden they did.
That's right. And, it may be something that was not designed by an individual person or a small group of people. It may be just something that's what evolved over a period of time. And that's why I think I'm concerned about this artificial intelligence, because what I've seen with AI, I don't think it's very intelligent, but if it starts making decisions, we'll probably pine for the days of the $500 toilet seat.
Well, you know, I've actually, you know, you kick up some of these questions about companies, about PE ratios and all that kind of stuff, and then whenever I Google it now, the AI thing pops up, and I've had many occasions where those numbers are wrong.
Oh
where,
yeah.
Where you go down to a real article, you go to Yahoo Finance or someplace or Bloomberg or somewhere, and you find out that the AI thing is totally wrong. Like, where the hell are they getting that number?
I remember from my initial foray into computer. Science, computer security, the old saying, garbage in, garbage out. Well, you know, AI doesn't seem to be any different than that.
I have a question for two dudes that have spent parts of their lives researching things. It's getting, on the internet, it's getting harder and harder, like, for me to do some research. I mean, I'm not really good at it, so that's why I'm asking you guys. If I want to get a Washington Post article, okay, well, if I'm not paying the Washington Post, I can't get it. Same thing with the London Times. Same thing with, the Los Angeles Times. Same thing really with the Tribune. Okay, and if I want to go to the DePaul Library, Law Library, I don't know that they let me in. How does AI allegedly get in all these places and do all this research? Do they have contracts with all these people, or do they just hack their way in, or they don't get in, or what do they do?
I think it's copyright violations. So one of the things going on is in the news media, which I try to track, because that's how I started my career, newspapers. They originally, 30-some years ago, thought, well, we'll just give people stuff for free and we'll build up our readership. And then Rupert Murdoch was kind of a holdout on that, make people pay for the Wall Street Journal and so forth. And now, to go to the first part of your question, I think increasingly the news sites are saying, if you want to read it, even one article, you got to pay, or more than two articles, you got to pay. And sometimes when I go through end of the year tax thing and I think, why am I subscribing to the San Francisco Chronicle or something? And then I think, oh, because I wanted to read an article and I took a 10-day free subscription 8 months ago. So they want most of us to pay, but I think some of the AI companies are like the, you know, 600-pound gorilla. They just take it.
Why do you take it if you can't get in? I mean, if I kick up a Wall Street Journal article that I don't subscribe to, a couple guys in the office do, the first thing that happens, I see like the first 10 lines, and then the thing comes up and says,
right,
by the way, you better sign up or see ya. And how would I get in if I was AI? Unless I
don't think you do. Now there's other programs, and they call them deep dive data mining programs that maybe more sophisticated AI. And that's a whole different ball game. Now we're getting into sort of computer cyber espionage, used by, you know, the CIA and National Security Agency, and the guy who's kind of cornered the market on this for the intelligence community is Peter Thiel, who of course was Elon Musk's co-founder, maybe not founder is the right word, because they didn't really never found anything, but stole it from other people. But he's the old business colleague of Elon Musk on PayPal, for one thing, and other companies. So when we talk at that level, then you know, any sort of firewall where you got to park your credit card there is meaningless with those types of systems, because they can get around it.
Well, if you guys were going to fall back into activity here and write a history of the two alleged new Air Force Ones, not the one from Qatar, somewhere, some way, there was a 3.6. This is what I've been able to find out. There was a $3.6 billion budget to buy those two planes that I think were they were at the end of the run and somebody didn't want them or couldn't afford them or something. Some airline went out of business. So essentially the government bought those planes. So they originally were, I think, just regular passenger planes or designed for that. And they've got this $3.6 billion. Now, why they need two, but they do, evidently. And somewhere along the line, a few years later, and I don't know if it was Obama, Trump, Biden, somebody agreed to go, okay, it's not 3.6 anymore, it's now 5.3. Now, with my background, I know that came with not just a bunch of guys doing an overrun. It had to do probably with an awful lot of changes to what maybe the new president wanted, the old president, or they just defense stuff, or the stuff you guys are talking about, electronic warfare stuff that happened in the meantime, and oh no, we got to take care of this and that, and that. And all of a sudden, it's up to 5.3. Now, whether that means you had to scuttle some of the stuff you already had in there and start all over again, I don't know. My question is anybody capable of writing this article? I mean, I could do that for the Amtrak cars, and it would have taken me 6 months, which it did, but I could pretty much tell you day by day what change this happened. That's why this gave us 5 weeks delay and this change here. And oh, by the way, this change was already in the cars. We had to tear the old crap out and put the new crap in. I mean, it's a real big deal. And maybe because I worked on it, I'm much more into this than most. But somewhere along the line, all this stuff has happened. And maybe Boeing is to blame as well. Maybe they didn't say, maybe they go, okay, if you make this change, it'll be a 2 month delay, and it turned out to be a 10 month delay. So maybe Boeing is somewhat culpable along the line as well. But I guess the question is, does anybody really know what this history is? Maybe the changes came during Trump's administration. Who knows? I mean, I'm not accusing him of that, but I mean, or maybe Boeing is just lax. I mean, how does anybody? Everybody's got an opinion based on your political affiliation. Does anybody know the story? I guess is my question.
Well, I if you asked me that question a few years ago, I would have said, yeah, that sort of article could probably be written based on a Freedom of Information Act request, maybe interviews with confidential sources. But with the advent of this administration, you've not only got the administration attacking, you know, the National Archives and the Freedom of Information Act requests system and threatening anyone who talks to a member of the media with being charged under the Espionage Act, I don't think that article could be written now because there's just the openness to government information is being closed by the day. And I mean, the Library of Congress, which I always found to be a great place to go. You mentioned, you know, getting access to newspaper articles that they charge for, but down at the Library of Congress, their computer terminals, you can get on LexisNexis, you can get on ProQuest, which actually gets you free access to Wall Street Journal articles. Some libraries may still have that access. Probably the larger ones, but I don't think that article could be written. I like a lot of articles couldn't be written right now because of this this closure by the administration to government data, government information, and
it appears, this is just observation, that a lot of younger people either don't care, either don't find it significant. It's the same people who, and again, this is not a shot, it's the same people that have to use their credit card to get their coffee because they don't really care if somebody reads their credit card off the coffee thing or something. They don't worry about it. Maybe because the credit cards will cover it. Maybe because I've actually had younger people say convenience is so much more important to me than safety in a lot of ways. I mean, I've actually told me that to my family. But I mean, how does, when the stuff that you and I and Andrew and a lot of other people, one of the stuff that we see, the little nick of the freedom, the little cover this up, cover that, when, if ever, does that become significant to somebody who, I use the term, don't take this as an insult, has a real life, you know, has a family, has kids going to school and a job, and you don't really have time to keep track of, and all of a sudden, one day you're going to go, wait a minute, I can't do that anymore, or something. I mean, when if ever, do people wake up, or is it going to be too late?
Well, it could be too late. And let me make try to make a quick points. But one, if you were the assignment editor chief, and you've got a news organization, and you assign somebody to do that story, it would inevitably turn into a long, complicated, weeks-long investigation, unless you had Wayne, who does things quickly. And then it would come in, and people would say, yeah, but that was last month's story. Let's make it 600 words. And the reporter and the editors and the photographers are saying, what about our big investigation? And they say, yeah, but we've moved on. So that's one practical difficulty. But since I pose it, you're the assignment editor, how am I wrong on that?
Well, that's, I think it's a lot of you don't really see the last one. Again, I don't read the Washington Post that much anymore, but you guys remember the article? I forget the, maybe, boy, if you can help me, I'd like to find it, because I can't find it. It had to do with despair, where the money goes, and like in the welfare and the Social Security, and essentially ended up, he called it the horseshoe of despair. I don't know if you guys remember this article. It was probably 5-6 years ago, where the guy traced the horseshoe. He started investigating. I think he was in West Virginia, and he went south and across the South and back up across the Mississippi to basically Missouri or Arkansas or someplace. So his investigation looked like a horseshoe. That was essentially why he called it the. And he went from this county to that county, and what people were feeling, and how everybody's on Social Security, long-term disability here. And he found a couple of trailers in West Virginia where there were 10 people living in there, and nobody ever came out, and they were getting 8 checks for various types of welfare and this kind of thing. And one of the kid was supposedly autistic, and he's getting paid for that, even though he never went to the doctor, and they wouldn't say. I mean, the stories he had, and it was probably a 4 or 5 day, 3 or 4 page thing that you used to see in the paper, one of the papers, once a month or every couple of months, some real in-depth stuff that one of you guys might write. You don't really see that much anymore, and those are the Pulitzer Prize type articles. And I don't, is nobody doing that kind of work? It's what I used to like. When we lived down south, Dr. J and I and this other guy, we had this big house in Beverly. We first started trading. And we used to switch off whichever one we got cheaper, Time or Newsweek, and we always got U.S. News and World. So if there'd be something, like the Israelis and the Palestinians, you get all your news stuff during the day, and maybe you get an article here, an article there. Then all of a sudden you'd get your weekly magazine where one or two of those things would have a 15-page deal. Here's all the maps. Here's the planes. Well, there's no planes for Gaza, but if they're fighting the Syrians, say, here's all the planes and all the tanks that the Israelis got. Here's the maps. Here's what the Syrians. You get this huge explanation of all this stuff going on. I can't find that anywhere now. Is it just gone, or am I just an idiot? I can't find it.
It's the MBAs and the hedge funds and so forth control so much of the big picture financial decisions that they say the investment in that kind of story in terms of paying staff is not worth the return. So they've pretty much stopped doing it. Your perceptions are accurate. And here's one other pivotal reporting story in my career 45 years ago that's even got a Chicago angle I'd like to share with you, and of course to the listeners. You use the word culpable in terms of these cost overruns. Now let me boil this down, but I was working for the Hartford Courant covering courts, and somewhat by mistake, a huge grand jury investigative file of General Dynamics was left out in public, and it was cost overruns on defense contracts, particularly electric boat, submarine facility in Connecticut. And I was able to look at all of this secret stuff because they forgot to seal it. And this became a huge story that the federal government was criminally investigating these cost overruns, billions of dollars, and this is probably 45 years ago. So it was a big amount of money. And ultimately, after all these years, all this documentation, there was no charges made. And I had an authoritative source who said, look, this stuff is complicated, and our view is unless you got a 75% or 80% chance of conviction, we could get an indictment, but unless you get 75-80+ chance of conviction, it's not right to indict a company and cause all the havoc. And I ended up talking to Albert Jenner on getting a quote on this kind of stuff. You know, of course, he's huge figure. He's on the Warren Commission. The Jenner and Block, the Chicago law firm, is named after him. But that lesson that you don't announce investigations, you don't indict people unless you can get a conviction, has stayed with me. But it also goes to, I think, your larger point, culpability. Well, the criminal law is a very blunt instrument, was the lesson I took from that. But now we're seeing announcements of investigations frequently with very little chance of conviction.
Well, I know from my, again, the railroad cars versus Air Force One, you're talking, you know, whatever, amoebas versus, you know, animals, in terms of one complexity versus the other. And I'm going to say one of the most difficult things to do is to figure out what a change halfway through the project or a third of the way, what it's going to cost you in terms of time and what it's going to cost you in terms of money.
And that was the point.
Yeah.
I think my source was saying is, yeah, it's billions of dollars of cost overruns. And I think the unspoken part is we think that they were padding it. But if you have change orders that are coming from the government, how are you going to prove beyond reasonable doubt criminal intent?
What? Yeah, and some of that, when you're dealing with Air Force One, some of that could be classified. It is.
Yeah.
And we don't know what kind of systems they're putting in. I know there's, you know, the present Air Force One, the 747, modified 747, can shoot out the cannons loaded with chaff. In other words, if there's a heat-seeking missile, it'll go for that instead of the plane itself. And now you're getting into kind of classified stuff. And who knows? They may even have an escape pod in this new Air Force One.
Well, they did in the movie.
Yeah, and you know, and I'll tell you that I always said Hollywood seems to be far ahead of reality in many cases. So this sounds like it's a black hole of a government procurement. But you know, it may be just that. The number of people involved, you'll have the Secret Service involved, you'll have the CIA and NSA, and they all have these are all stakeholders in this plane. And
I'll give you an example of how, again, on a much lesser scale, the Amtrak cars, which are still riding around, the double decker Amtrak cars, those are cars that I walked on 45 years ago.
Oh yeah, I've been on them.
Yeah, and they're nice, they're terrific cars. I'm going to say that I did a, this is, you know, it's not about my work at Pullman. We were having cost overruns, Pullman. And I, you know, I was pretty good at financial analysis, and my boss said to me, on the QT, I want you to give me a cost of where do you think we're going to land on this contract. And the contract was officially, it was about $600,000 a car. This was the price. And there were some change orders made a little more. And we were hopelessly behind. I mean, we were supposed to have delivered the entire contract of 200 and however many cars it was, 84 or something. And we hadn't delivered car one, right? So, and I spent about 5 days on it, went around the plant. I had free hand to talk to anybody. And I came back and I wrote it up and handed it to him back when you actually, you know, typed the thing up and everything. And he says, what are we going to do? I said, we're going to lose $1 million a car. He goes, we're going to do what? I go, I tried it three different ways, just by people on the property, by time, by whatever. I don't see how it comes out any different. This is what we're spending a day, and this is my new schedule. And I did it three different ways. And he goes, why'd you do it three different ways? I go, because I didn't want to believe it either. And we ended up losing like $990 a car. I was within $10,000. But it was... But every single, you know, the impossible thing to determine is I actually did some of the change orders. They'd say, okay, instead of this type of seat, we want this kind of seat. Well, on day one, you can do that on day when you've already got seats delivered. Either you got to send them back or retrofit them, but nobody can predict with any kind of certainty if you everybody's working on a project. Now there's only two planes, there's still probably a couple hundred people working on them. If you get delayed a month, if you don't immediately lay all those people off, in which case they might go somewhere else, if you keep them working, doing like other stuff, and you lose 2 months, good Lord, in terms of money and everything else. But I mean, I can't believe that in today's world that those two planes, whenever they're done, or the new plane, if they actually do it like they say they're going to do, that it is remotely close to the original contract that was signed 10 years ago, 8 years ago. I can't believe it, just from what I've seen. Now, I know it's probably not the show for that, but, I mean, at some place somewhere, I think somebody should make that, instead of just accusing everybody, I mean, I got to believe that the electronic warfare stuff isn't even close to where it was designed 7 years ago. You guys think?
Oh, absolutely. And then there's the convenience stuff. Like, I'm sure they want Wi-Fi on this new plane. But then the NSA will say, yeah, but it's got to be secured from eavesdropping. It's what I'm saying. That you got so many outside players involved, it gets to be like I hate to use the term, but Chinese fire drill.
Yeah, pretty much. Hey, we got to go to break, guys. SP Futures down 31, NASDAQ Futures down 108. So much for the rally. And then, Hughes, it's like the same thing as yesterday. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm out. Ricky and Jim on the board. SP Futures down 30, NASDAQ Futures down 103. Again, we were up when we came in a little bit after yesterday's loss. Just as a way of review, yesterday we were down pretty heavy. The Dow was down, my computer's a little 816, so that's a number. It's almost 2%. S&P was down 95, 1.6%. NASDAQ down 270. That actually wasn't as bad at 1.4 because Google was up. So we had Google kind of carrying some of the NASDAQ not as far down. Today, but Europe has been not moving down like we have the last couple days. All of a sudden, the DAX down 272 today. It's 1.1%. The FTSE down 94, 1.1%. CAC around down 101, 1.3. Bonds, 10-year, and this is what's causing a lot of the problem. The 10-year is now 4.63. Remember last week we were saying if we got over 4.5, it might be a little bit of an issue. 30-year Treasury is 5.1. As House advances this tax bill, which is adds to the deficit like there's kind of no tomorrow, but we're not supposed to believe that, I guess. Oil down 88 cents, 60.69, still the low 60s, but that's a 1.5% move. Brent down 91 cents, 64 bucks. Natural gas down 7 cents, 329. Gold has been running up, but now today it's down 270. It was down more earlier. It's rallied back. It was down like 20 bucks not more than a half hour ago. 33.10. Silver down 68 cents. That's a pretty good move. 32.96. Federal FX. The dollar has been the pound is like a 3-year high here at 1.113. It was 1.11 a couple weeks ago. And again, we'll talk with the guys in a minute here about what a 2% move in a currency means in a short period of time. It's like a 40% move in a stock market or 30 somewhere in there. British pound unchanged at 1.34. Again, that's the one that's at the record high here for the last 3-year high. Not record, but last 3-year high. Crypto, which continues to run up. Up 3,300, 111,415. I don't know. I was going to say something about the administration's affiliate. Somehow or another, they're pushing these things. And I just hope that doesn't come to bite us all in the butt someday. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. What do you guys for traffic, weather, sports?
Yes, Chief. Well, in Chicago, it's 47 degrees. The high will be 52. It's cloudy, obviously, and we are going to have periods of rain. In Phoenix, it's currently 74 with a high of 106. Right now, the inbound Kennedy is running at 28 minutes. The inbound Edens is at 35. The inbound Eisenhower is at 34. The Ryan Express is at 17, and the inbound Stevenson at 23. The White Sox lost to Seattle yesterday 5-7. The Cubs beat the Marlins 2-1. And Arizona lost to the Dodgers 3-1. In the NHL, the Stars beat the Oilers 6-3. And Chief, we were wrong. The Pacers did win 138-135 over the Knicks. So they take a one-game lead.
Was that in Indiana or was that in New York?
In New York.
Okay. That's going to be a close series, I think. That's going to be, I don't know, the other one I don't think will be, but that one might be close. Well, so, guys, what do you make of this interest rate run-up? This bill, the idea, you know, the WAGs will say that, you know, we're trying to tax the people that everybody's always trying to help, middle class and lower class, through tariffs, and we're going to give the benefits to the upper class. And I'm going to say that that's pretty accurate, it appears, doesn't it?
It certainly does to me. you know, I think it was a close vote for this budget bill. And had it not been for the fact that a few Democratic members of the House have died, and most recently Jerry Connolly in Northern Virginia, it might have actually failed if those votes were there. But you know, we see some governors in some states, Republican governors, are holding off the special election to fill those seats, which would certainly go to Democrats until the November general election. So I think there's we don't know what the Senate version of this budget bill is a bit different than the House's.
Well, I just no matter what, whoever runs for office, no matter what somebody says, everybody's helping the middle class, and all it does is go downhill every year. I mean, so obviously they're not helping them too much.
They speak with fork and tongue.
Yeah, it's I mean, I just the whole idea. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff wrong with our tax system, and some of it I think can be somewhat easily put back together. But there's a few things that the administration, economically, I have a huge problem with, and I think we've learned from Carl and other people that maybe in some regards tariffs or other things, maybe other things that we could discuss, need to happen to even up abuses like child labor and other places, like drugs coming in from places you don't clean as well as maybe you do here. Those kinds of things somehow need to be evened up. You can't let the guy on your side of the Rio Grande not pour, pollution into the Rio Grande, but on the Mexican side they can. You need to be attentive to those types of inequalities, I think. Now, but I will stand by my economic feelings that a broad general tariff, belongs in the locker with Smoot and Hawley. It's a horrible economic idea, just in general. And the idea that somehow if you screw your trading partners, you'll end up better. You may end up a little least screwed, but I think that's a horrible idea to screw your customers just in general. I'm not talking about, China with slave labor and doing something against those guys, but to throw something on, Switzerland or Luxembourg or some damn place just to do it,
yeah.
I think I wonder about the dumbing down of our society, that how many people actually know or believe the crap that the tariff is a tax on China and not us. Anybody who believes that, I think, needs to go back to school or something.
Well, they're going to see it, or they're already seeing it in some of these places. There's a national chain called Five and Below. Everything in that place, I'd say at least 95% of what they sell is from China. So the stuff comes in the containers, ships to Long Beach, and then it on the train, and then the stuff gets distributed. But this five and below, it was like $5 and below. You go in there now, even though that's still the name of the place, and there's stuff now over $10. So there's the tariff on China at work. And you know, these places are popular with kids because you can go in and get accessories for your iPhone, and you know, not as much as if you went to the Apple store or whatever. But you know, when these young people start seeing those prices, even if they're not voters, they're going to be complaining to their parents. I think there's going to be a heck of a payback on Election Day, if there is an Election Day.
But you know, if you were to ask the normal American, and whoever that could be, I mean, who do you suppose would be the normal American? Boy, I can't even imagine who that person, male or maybe a female, might be. I mean, if you were to say, do you realize that the blue jeans that you get from China or something, or the, you know, the polo shirt or whatever, I'm not sure where they're built made, but that it's, you know, there's people working there for 2 cents an hour, and oh, by the way, they might be 13 years old, or by the way, they might be the Uyghurs? They might just be slave labor. And you say, don't you think you should be buying this other pair of blue jeans for $80 instead of 50? First thing out of their mouth, they're going to say, I can't afford the 80.
Yeah.
So you can't divorce the lack of progress, I won't even say progress, the lack of being able to keep up of every American prices versus wages for the last 25 years. You can't divorce that problem from them willing to buy stuff from everywhere. They don't care what happens. They just can't afford something else. I mean, right? I mean, it's all part of like the same picture. Is, you know, the more I do the show, and the more I listen to the various people on the show, the more it's becoming the same movie, isn't it? Or is it just me?
No. Well, I think that's it. I mean, and people just don't, you know, really having to watch.
Wayne, your mic is going out and up. Andrew, are you is yours working?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much going on, people just have time for headlines. But what you're doing, you're the, I wouldn't say the Pied Piper, the Cassandra, who's actually a very noble role. You're telling people, you got to get beyond the headlines, because this is going to smack you. But people don't want to hear. And I think even Mark Twain or these people 150 years ago said, look, the hardest persuasion there is to convince somebody he's been made a fool of. I think he probably said it a lot more amusingly.
Yep.
But the concept is people act on the headlines, and then they get hit and hurt, and they don't want to be thinking that they were wrong. They want to find a new target.
Well, what do you guys, you know, a little bit of history and what the ladies on the show has been telling us. When my grandfather was a master boilermaker, he worked for the railroad, right? He'd come home same time every day. Dinner was always ready. I bet he went to a restaurant once in his life the day that his house burned down and my uncle dragged him there. The thought of them even going out would never happen. He would never go to a bar. He was a man of the Depression, you know, and he was a great guy. But one thing's for sure, somebody, it wasn't me or my aunt, one of us scuttered to the corner every night and got him the Tribune, the first, whatever the edition was, that came out six the night before. He sat down at the table and he read it cover to cover, especially the financial stuff, because he liked investing. But he had, you know, a job that was difficult, but it also was 7 to 3:30, wherever the hell it was, and he maybe worked on weekends if he did some boilermaker stuff for, like, a school or someplace, because he was good at it. But today, Nancy talks about, we went from having a job to both people in the family working. When she does mortgages now, she says, we're up to, like, 2.5 jobs, and I'm certainly going to put raising a family in there as a full-time job, even if you only got a couple kids, much less four or five. She says that most people now, to make mortgages meet and to make, you know, for the kids' traveling teams and everything, not only are both the husband and wife working, and but maybe one of them, if they're an accountant, is doing taxes on the weekends in the spring or the winter, or is doing something where they're, because they still can't really make ends meet. Now, you know, then you got somebody like me who's going to say, people should read all these detailed articles. I don't think people have anywhere near the time. It's one thing to say people should know more, should know about the effects of tariffs, should know about this, should know about that. But the stuff's coming at you out of Washington so damn fast. Unless it's your job like mine to watch this stuff for people all day and to do the show, or you guys that have been in that industry, how the hell can anybody else keep up? And how can you accuse somebody of, hey, I'm never going to insult somebody by saying, you don't know anything about the Boeing thing with the country and who's at fault for the delay, and it might have been Trump's speech. Nobody knows. I mean, what you're going to do is you're going to pick out the headline of the side you like, and you're going to believe it. I mean, and I understand why they're doing it. I wish they weren't, but I don't see any other way that they can put the time in that you and I are doing. I mean, can you?
Well,
I mean,
of course, and you can't. Nobody's trying to blame the victim here, which is the ordinary person trying to get by. What's missing, I think, is trusted leaders. And of course, you know, all of us here, you know, we find the chinks in the armor, the feet of clay of the leaders, but we really need people who, even if they have faults, are basically decent leaders who can interpret the complicated stuff for the regular people. And that's why, in some ways, toss the thing to Wayne here, if you don't mind, but Wayne has done in-depth research on the new Pope. And he's been writing very illuminating articles this past week, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to watch through the Vatican media system, because only they have drones to watch the ceremonies. And I think it's because this is a leadership change on a global scale, where we need to know, what are these people like? What are their interactions with each other? Because everybody can't do all the research.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about the Pope, and this is just coming from location. This guy being Pope is probably, in the last 10 or 15 years, is the single most positive thing that has happened to the south side of Chicago in the last two decades. Is the way people
right,
feel.
I was going to say the south side lost one of their native sons yesterday. George Wendt, who we all know played Norm Peterson on Cheers, passed away. So it's nice to know we have another south sider in a pretty important job.
South side's an unusual place. One of my best friends married George's younger sister, so I actually know the family really well.
Oh, how about that?
And didn't see George that much because he's been living in California, but once
right.
in a while I'd see him. And the South Side is such an unusual spot in some ways. I mean, maybe a couple times we'd be over there and it'd be like a big graduation party or something, and George would be there. It's only happened a couple times. George and his buddy Peter Burns, who used to be a board broker in the CBOE, a real nice guy, and funnier than all get out, he was a Second City guy. He did a couple of guest appearances, I believe, on Crime Story or The Untouchables, or one of those things, and here in Chicago. And he, George goes, hey, let's go over to Dingbats for a beer. So off we go. this is George's favorite bar. And you walk in, and George is just a guy from Beverly. Hey, yeah. George, how are you? Sit down. Not one guy running over for autographs. Not one guy calling the press.
Nobody yelled out Norm.
No, God no. And there's no camera out in front. There's a celebrity in the place. It's yeah. And the South Side. He's just George. I mean, he grew up. The whole family. There's like 8 kids
so,
in the family.
So his character actor, which was actually in Boston, His character, he was sort of like that character anyway.
Yeah, right? I'm gonna bet that just about, I want percentage, I mean, I know over all these things have writers, he was so quick, which you get from being in Second City, because it's all improv, right? Or a lot of it's improv. Yeah. I'm going to say that a lot of times during the discourse, they just let him do his own line. I don't think, like, even when he walked in and every day they would, how was your day? Something about, I'm wearing dog biscuit underwear and I went through a herd of dogs or something. I'm going to say a lot of that stuff might have just been him. He just was that quick.
It almost sounds like it. It sounded too much of an ad lib when I saw a collection they had on YouTube of all his entrances into Cheers. He'd always have some, you know, I'd say, Norm, and then somebody say, you know, what's up? And he says, me after I have a beer.
But you know, if you were with the guy, he'd say, let's go grab a beer. And so the thought that I am a celebrity, if I go somewhere, people will be staring at me, never even crossed his mind.
No.
And nobody ever did. A couple times I was on him. The couple times that he was, the paparazzi nailed him, was in New York, where you would see something here about George coming out the back doors of some nightclub or something. But that never happened here. He just was George from the South Side.
Yeah, yeah.
The family's all real quick too. It's not just him. The mom had an absolutely quick wit as well. I mean, the whole family. I think I met the dad once. He died a long time ago. He's been dead a while. But George's 76. The dad's probably been dead. But the dad didn't make it to 76. But I think he was real quick witted too. But the family the family's fun to be around. Fun to be around.
Right.
But it's a big loss. But he has not been well for a while. I don't think.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get the skinny on it, and if I did, I wouldn't say. But I didn't ask because I don't want to know. But I don't know if the funeral is going to be there or here. She's from here, and so is he. So, if the service is here, if I can get into the church, I'll try and go. I'm sure it'll be at St.
Not only church, and then of course find a bar to toast them afterwards.
Oh yeah,
right?
You don't normally come across regular people that are talented and just never change, you know?
Right. Andy and I, we know a guy who used to be a co-host of a show on NBC and was a writer for Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and he's about as regular a guy as you're going to find, too.
Well, I called my buddy yesterday, and I said, you know, his sister's name is Marty. I said, how's Marty? Is she a mess? And he goes, well, pretty much. And what you would expect. I mean, she was telling the kids that... that no matter what scheme, no matter what she asked George to do, looking back on it, she goes, no matter how stupid it was, in retrospect, he always dropped whatever he was doing and did what I asked him to do, even though he knew it was probably a waste of time. It didn't matter. He just, you know, okay, she's my sister. She wants me to do something, even though it's probably not something we need to do. I'm going to do it anyway. You know, he just was at, you know, I mean, it's rare to find people like that. It really is.
Especially in you know, among Hollywood, people. But I know from talking to Andy and I's mutual friend, you know, we all saw Don Rickles do that act. You know, he's an insult comic, right? But people said when he wasn't on stage, if there was a death in the family or illness or something, he'd be the first guy to call and say, is there anything I can do? So
if you want to see something on YouTube that's one of the funnier skits, it was the night that the yuppie couple came in and took Norm's seat. It's on YouTube. It's hilarious.
Yes.
And he's like, well, you're in my seat.
That's right. He had the corner seat. Right.
You know, the other, I keep forgetting his name, Cliffy.
Cliff the postman. Yeah,
yeah, he was on, I saw him, I've watched a lot of Hill Street Blues. He was on a few of those episodes as like a burglar or something. Like a checkered sport coat. I'm going, God, that's Cliffy.
Yeah, right.
I mean, some of the costumes they used to wear for those.
It's the problem when you're typecast and you're in another role, everybody, William Shatner, you know, we all know him as Captain Kirk, but you know, when he played a cop in T.J. Hooker,
yeah,
people, like, why is he firing an actual gun? Where's his phaser? You know, I mean.
Plus, he was a star in probably one of the best Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Where we
yeah.
jumped out of the window of the plane to get the gremlin.
The thing was on the, yeah, there's something on the wing, right.
And he also was with Paul Newman. What was the name of that movie when he was a very young actor? Where he was in the court decision. It wasn't The Verdict. It was, but he was, Paul Newman was the attorney, and he was the junior attorney. Long career and a lot of, I thought he was terrific in Boston Legal.
Oh, right. Yeah,
that absolutely. I actually watched the one the other day with where they had the $50,000 bet if you get Clarence Thomas to say something. You guys remember that one? Where they?
I don't. But Andy's the expert on Clarence Thomas. I don't know. Did you ever hear about that?
No, I didn't. But
you got to watch it. Just search for James Spader Supreme Court or Boston Legal Supreme Court. Well, first of all, he's going to the Supreme Court, and Denny wanted to come with. And Denny, you know, was losing it mentally, so he didn't want him to come with. And Denny's like, what are you talking about? You got to at least bring me with. He had promised not to say anything, right? So they get there. They had a $50,000 bet that he could make Clarence Thomas say something, because at that time he never said anything, right? So he's sitting there, and he's talking, and at one point he goes to Clarence Thomas, Judge Thomas, would you please get rid of the Sports Illustrated you're looking at or something. You know, Clarence Thomas, something. He didn't say any words. He just grunted. He turned around, where's my 50?
With Clarence Thomas, we know it wouldn't have been Sports Illustrated.
Well, whatever. But but he turned around, he said, I won my 50 grand. this bill, is it going to make it through? I mean, they put, how many amendments, was it up? 40-some or 100 amendments last night to get the thing through?
By one vote in the House. Everyone predicted it would win in the House. I think it'll go through in the Senate. There'll be more problems there, but the problem that the Republicans and actually the opponents face is, since it's the one main bill for the year, anybody who wants anything done, they got to pass it. I mean, I just read a story this morning that talked about 10 major companies, including United Airlines, but many of them in the communications business, Comcast, AT&T, that are lobbying furiously behind the scenes to make this happen. And most people in the public don't know this because it's all done quietly, but there's huge muscle to make it happen. And since there's really no alternative, it's likely to go through.
Well, the bill's 1,000 pages long, right?
Yeah, and part of it, what you know, as it comes to light in the light of day, literally, because it's much of it's revealed at midnight. There's a tax break for people who have tanning salons in their home.
What is the idea that tip income is not income? And a lot of my friends, you know, work in the hospitality business. What manner of moron would think of that? Why is that not income?
Well, because during the presidential race, when Nevada was considered a swing state, Trump made a campaign promise that seemed to have worked out, that he's going to cut people in the hospitality sector a break. So if the president says it that's what happens.
Well, that's the same thing that when Hoover, during his campaign, said we're going to have tariffs, and by the time he signed it, he damn near put the world under.
Mm-hmm.
What's up? Yep. Well, how is it that, you know, Illinois clearly has its warts, but legislatively they've gone a totally different direction than the Congress. I mean, we had somebody on, God, a few years ago, that was working on some, I'll use the term, bill, for like, it was not really a bill, but it was something that was supposed to go through Congress. It was a an idea, a law. And I asked the guy, well, what are you guys waiting for? And he said, well, we're just waiting for a bill to attach it to. And now, Illinois, we had a couple of guys on that were senators in Illinois. Illinois has gone the other way. One bill, one subject. Where they don't,
right.
They try their best to not do that. Now, on the federal level, it seems like they're getting worse and worse, for lack of a better term. That you're right, everything is in one bill. But you'll see the agriculture bill might be God knows what's in there. You know, just because people can't get another, why can't they just pass individual bills for individual things?
Well, now we're getting to the end of the hour, but reformers like to say the system is broken, and some of us in Washington watching the system saying, what do you mean it's broken? It's working perfectly for the insiders. It's not broken. It's only broken for the little people.
Well, I think that's kind of true. Maybe next week we'll tee up why that is. I think part of that is, and again, I'm not a massive pusher of unions, certainly not government unions, because I think they got a little corrupted as time went by as well.
Oh, but, yeah.
but I'm saying they were, maybe not even on purpose, they were the lobbying group for the middle class, because there were a lot of things that were important to both. And since they've been not around, I think the middle class doesn't have anybody else. When we first started the show, I said something about we need a regular guy lobby. Everybody should send $100 send $100 in to the Stocks and Jacks lobby for the middle class. And every time somebody shoves $1,000 into Durbin's pocket to do one thing, we're going to shove $1,000 in the other pocket and say that's not what we want. I got so much backlash. Why should I have to do that? These guys should know what I want. I vote for them. I'm like, are you on a different planet? Your vote, they don't even know who you are. They don't know how you're thinking. How do they, unless you're willing to tell them, which means money, they don't know or care. I mean, next week, what do you say we tee that up? Because I think that's an interesting, what would have to happen to turn this away from the select few? And it would have to be the other people got money too, right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, you guys have a nice weekend. Any special for Memorial Day weekend? Any special doings?
Well, I think I'm going to tip a brewski later on today for George.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I'll see you guys one of these days. SP Futures now up to. We were up, then we were way down. Now we're back up. Up, down. NASDAQ Futures up 55, so maybe it'll be a positive day. Who knows? We'll talk about it tomorrow morning. Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.